Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm honored to be speaking with Dr. Jane Hamlett and Dr. Julie Mary Strange about a great book that they published with Reaction Publications. The book is called Pet Revolution, Animals and the Making of Modern British Life, published in 2023. Jane Hamlett is a professor of modern history at Royal Holloway, University of London, and Julie Mary Strange is professor of modern British history at Durham University. Jane and Julie, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you for having us so much.
It's sort of customary to ask our guests to briefly introduce themselves and tell us about their field of expertise, how they became interested in their field, which in your case is British history. So I would appreciate if you could briefly introduce yourself. Maybe you should start with Julie.
Hi, so I'm Julie Marie, and I'm a British historian, and I'm particularly interested in the history of everyday life and the politics of everyday life, including kind of everyday inequalities. So that's my background.
Thanks, and Jane.
Great. I'm also a historian of Britain. I think I sort of came into the study of British history really through my interest in women's history, and I'm particularly interested in the history of the family, private life, and the home.
This is such a fascinating topic that you've chosen, and this is a topic that never even occurred to me. I just remember that a few years ago I'd read an article about pets, how even the word, the phenomenon of pet became more common. But can you tell us what made you decide to write this book? How did the idea of this book come to you?
Well, I think we've both been interested in the history of the family and in family lives and relationships for quite a long time. And I think we both felt that actually animals often have a really important role to play in the household and an important role to play in families as well. But actually, that hasn't really made it into historical studies of the home and family, certainly not in the context of modern Britain, which is what we were looking at. So I think that was one of the primary reasons why we chose to write this book.
And we both have pets. So I think because we both had pets, I think we became so aware of how much animals, bringing animals into your life and your home, really changes your experience of your domestic environment, but also your experience of your human-to-human relationships. Animals are persons in their own right, and they really change the dynamics of a household, whether that's the material affective experience of a household or whether that's the interpersonal relationships within that household.
I'm currently trying to convince my wife to have a pet, so I would definitely ask her to listen to this podcast. I know they're both sides. Yeah, I always show videos of
sometimes
cats
animals have an impact beyond what you anticipated.
Another question that I had is that your book is focused on England. So I can imagine why you decided to write this book on England. You're British historians. But can you tell us maybe from your research? Well, we'll talk about some of the details in the book, but can you tell us the trend or the materials you found about England? Was it more or less similar across Europe or even other parts of the world?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at other studies of pet keeping in the Western world, so say, for example, Kathleen Keats' work on 19th century America. Kathleen Keats' work on Pat Aris. There's another really well-known study of pets by Catherine Greer, slightly similar named academic from the US. And both of those both of those studies identify some similar trends in France and the US in terms of pet keeping becoming more acceptable across society, but particularly pet keeping being kind of celebrated by the middle classes in a certain way. So pet keeping does seem to be becoming sort of culturally important across the West in the 19th century. So if you look at our study alongside the work other historians are doing, you can see that trend.
But I think it's also worth saying that what was different about our book is that we wanted to look across the social classes. So we wanted to, it was a really ambitious project in that we wanted to expand what we understand about the history of pet keeping in the Western world beyond the middle classes. And so we were interested in whether or not pet keeping was accessible to people who were working class, and the way that your socioeconomic circumstance might change your access and your experience of pet keeping. And so I think the sheer scope of that study was really ambitious, and like on a pragmatic level, to undertake that level of study across the social classes, we had to be really quite focused in how we did it. And what we're hoping is that our kind of contribution to Kathleen Keat and Catherine Gear's work will prompt other studies of pet keeping in working class culture as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess we should say as well that this book came out of a kind of a research team project. So we had funding from the Arts and Humanities Research Council for it. And so we worked with a team of researchers, and that meant we were able to do a really large scale new survey of archival material. So we looked at autobiographies and memoirs, oral histories, and also things like manuscript diaries, some of which actually hadn't been studied before for any other purpose, as far as I can see. So we did a really big dive, if you like, into the archives for this project. And I think as Julie Marie says, I mean, it was only really, I think, feasible if we narrowed it down to England and Wales, which was our focus.
And when did this phenomenon of pet keeping become common in England? Did it start in Victorian England? And I guess the second part of my question is, where did they come from? Were they captured in the wild?
Yeah, I think it's really difficult to put a start date on the arrival of pet keeping, because if you think about pet keeping as a kind of emotional relationship between people and animals, actually some archaeologists think that might go back to the really, you know, a really early stage in human history, and perhaps, you know, the first sort of relationships that people have thought to have formed relationships with friendly wolves that eventually became dogs. So, you know, I think sort of that human emotional connection with animals goes very, very far back in history. But what we do think happened in the Victorian period was that pet keeping became more achievable for people across society, partly just due to sort of a rise in living standards, but also pet keeping seems to have become more culturally acceptable. And it's often associated with a celebration of the home and family that is also part of wider Victorian culture.
And you asked about the wild as well. A lot of pets do come from the wild. So, and that's one of the ways in which pet keeping is made accessible across social classes, because if you can capture an animal in the wild and tame them and bring them inside, that's obviously much more economically viable than having to purchase an animal. So actually in the Victorian period, and because it's not regulated, lots of pets are brought in from outdoors, and it's often really unusual pets. So squirrels, hedgehogs, kind of all these animals that we now think of as wild animals, the Victorians are quite happy to ensnare them and try and tame them indoors.
A very interesting part of your book was Eliza Brightman that you discussed. She wrote a book called Wild Nature Won by Kindness. Can you talk about this book, and also how did her writing sort of reinforce these gendered ideas regarding wildlife and plants and pets?
Yeah, I mean, I think her book is really quite fascinating. And she's part of a wider movement in the late 19th century that is starting to come to terms with nature and to try and begin to have some kind of understanding of the value of wildlife and the value of wildlife in terms of natural habitats. However, at the same time, Brightwyn is also of her time in that she does all kinds of things that we would find absolutely unacceptable in terms of animal welfare standards today. So she brings all kinds of wild animals into her house. At one point, she tries to adopt a badger, which I think was a very bad idea, and didn't go very well. So she's very interesting for us because she does represent a new trend in, I guess, the Victorian approach to wildlife. And you can see this in different other contexts, for example, the foundation of the Society for the Protection of Birds occurs around the same time. So there is this growing movement in Victorian society that's more aware of animal cruelty and the need to protect wildlife. And in fact, Diana Donald has written very interestingly as well in her book about the way in which this new kind of culture of awareness of cruelty does seem to be specifically gendered as feminine, and that actually women are kind of playing a real kind of a very sort of leading role in organizations that are campaigning for protection of birds, for example.
And you talked about that these animals were taken in wildlife, and some of them were really, really exotic, strange animals. But what sort of legal measures were taken to protect the wildlife in that time period?
Well, you do get some very early attempts to try and protect birds. And so it becomes illegal to capture birds in certain seasons. And also there are some measures as well that are more designed to protect animals as a whole that are focused on animal cruelty. So you do have these early measures, but they're not very effective. No one really knows exactly. Often there's quite a lot of confusion about which birds they apply to and when. Mm. And also it's incredibly hard to regulate that kind of activity on a mass scale. So bird capturing, particularly as a kind of activity that's encouraged amongst sort of small boys, and things like going out and sort of capturing birds or collecting eggs from a nest, still remains really, really common as a practice in the late 19th century, even though there are starting to be some attempts to kind of control that.
And another related question is the rise of pet markets and pet shops in England. I remember when I was a kid, I used to have, you know, some birds, and I feel guilty about, but anyway, I was a little boy and my dad used to take me to these pet shops, and there were lots of birds in cage. And it was quite interesting to read about these pet markets and pet shops in England as well. So when and how did they grow?
It does seem the process of kind of buying a pet becomes more commercialised in the 19th century. And we do see a number of different kinds of shops starting to offer pets to consumers in a new way. So, for example, if you look at department stores from the late 19th century, they quite often have a pet department, and they're often using pets in their marketing in a new way as well to try and get people to come into the shops. So we do see pets being sold and commodified in department stores and in smaller scale shops as well. Interestingly, it seems to be in the 20th century that shops start to call themselves pet shops. So prior to that, they might call themselves an animal shop, they might be a naturalist store, or they might sell pets alongside other things. But from the early 20th century, they start to use the word pet more in their marketing, which suggests that there's a growing awareness of the emotional value of these animals, and they're starting to really pick up on that and use it as a marketing tool. But I mean, there is also a much older kind of history of pet selling through markets as well.
Yeah, so markets are generally, they don't have the same overheads as shops. And so if you buy a pet from a street market, it's much cheaper usually. But also the growth in markets are also perhaps a response to growing anxieties about cruelty. So once you have people raising concerns about these practices of capturing things from the wild, many people see an opportunity, a market opportunity. And so what we start to see the emergence of is people breeding animals for domestic use. And so in a sense, the market responds to a growing anxiety about cruelty. And so we get this expansion in selling animals and birds that have been bred for a domestic market. So birds in particular, I mean, you start to get different species of birds. So really exotic birds, for example, that we once relied on to be imported through the colonies and through trade routes, now start to be bred in Britain for consumption as pets at home. So I think these things are all entangled.
And I don't remember exactly, some time ago I read about the first anti-animal cruelty laws in England. I think they were enacted towards the end of 18th or beginning of 19th century. I don't remember exactly.
Yeah, so the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals was founded 200 years ago, and they are pivotal in lobbying for anti-animal cruelty legislation. And what we see is from 1824 kind of a gathering pace of that legislation as the SPCA, as they then were, raise awareness about cruelty and actively mobilize and campaign for greater protection of animals.
Another really fascinating part of the book was street vendors. So it never occurred to me that even street vendors would sell pets or animals, and also all the negativity that was associated with them. So can you talk about this phenomenon? Tell us why street vendors were normally, you know, looked on with some kind of suspicion, or they were, you know, they were associated with people of bad morality.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the difficulties of getting back at the kind of realities of that situation is that many of our sources for life on the streets are created by middle and upper class writers who have a very particular perspective. They often feel morally superior to the people they're writing about, and often present them in a negative light. So I mean, a lot of our information about street vendors comes from Henry Mayhew's study of London street life from the 1850s. And Mayhew, he's very interesting. He is a kind of middle class journalist writing from a middle class perspective, and he is often quite sort of critical. And so I think we do have a more negative image of street sellers than we might have if we had different kinds of sources. And I think, you know, most of our representations of kind of London street life in the rest of the 19th century come from these middle class observers as well, who are often often quite negative, and we don't really get a sense of what it was like for working class consumers to actually go and buy from street vendors. We don't have that perspective at all. So I think that's why we've got that sort of more negative image. And I think we can see within the pet selling market, the way in which pet shops present themselves. I think they're responding to those negative stereotypes and often trying to counteract them a bit. But I think that's where they come from.
Although Henry Mayhew, some of his study, and he's particularly interested in street vendors of animals, and particularly of dogs. And one of the things he's very keen to get across in his study is that actually dog dealers in particular have been really unfairly represented as being kind of like criminal, and, you know, all their dogs, all their merchandise is stolen. And Mayhew says that there are very specific reasons for this negative stereotype. And he invites us to reflect and consider on maybe actually it's just not true. So as we start to get increased practices around pet keeping at the start of the 19th century, and particularly around dogs. Dogs are the most expensive pet you can purchase. Mm. They're very expensive to keep. And they are clearly the animal which the Victorians believe you have the most capacity to build an emotional relationship with, because dogs are really empathetic. And so as enterprising criminals recognize this, there is a trend, particularly in cities, for some people to steal dogs. And it's kind of a form of kidnap. So it's dog napping becomes a real moral panic, that your lovely dog who you adore and who is the center of your emotional life, you take it out for a walk, some criminal comes and steals it, and then sort of is willing to sell it back to you for a very high fee. And this becomes a real moral panic. Now, one of the things Mayhew asks is, well, just how common was this? And he's also asking what happens to the dogs where people don't pay the kidnapping fee, where they don't pay the ransom. And the assumption is that those are the dogs that end up back on the street being sold by street vendors, because street vendors don't have the same regulations. They're not checked. They don't have the same checks and balances that a shopkeeper would have. And so Mayhew actually unpicks where a lot of these stereotypes come from. But he also sounds a word of warning in saying that actually this may not be as common as we think. There was a real panic about dog kidnapping, and maybe it's just not as broad. He argues that most dog dealers are actually okay, that most, he also suggests that a lot of middle-class families buy pets for their children from street vendors too, because it's cheaper. So Mayhew actually really complicates our picture of street vendors, whilst acknowledging that there are a lot of negative stereotypes. Where we do have sources from working class people, and it's often oral histories where they're talking about being children, one of their key memories of childhood is going to markets and being invited to pick a pet, usually with a dad on a Saturday. And it's a real treat, whether it's for a birthday or Christmas. But that memory of going to a market stall and seeing and smelling all these animals and birds and being invited to pick one for yourself is a really vivid memory that stays with them into adulthood.
Mm. And speaking about the animals, we discussed how some of these animals were captured in the wild. And I must say that even for the benefit of our listeners, what I really like about the book is that it's you talk about the history, you talk about the role of gender, you talk about the role of colonialism in there as well. So there are many different aspects that you have looked at this topic from. And this one was also very interesting to me, that not all the birds and animals were captured in the wild. Some of them were imported into England. So can you talk about these animals and also the role of colonialism in this trade and creating this fascination with pets?
Yeah, I think so Britain's kind of position in the world and the growth of global trade does mean that it's more possible to transport a range of different exotic animals into the UK. And in fact, from the early 19th century, it becomes more possible to import exotic megafauna. And we see growth in things like zoos and menageries, where these animals are kind of being displayed to the British public. And often, you can see that process of the display of these exotic animals as working in tandem with imperial identities, if you like. So by showing a caged lion or a tiger or something like that, you're kind of demonstrating British imperial power over the rest of the world, and sometimes specifically over colonized spaces. So you can see the animal trade working in that way. I think there are a couple of really notable traders in exotic animals, particularly based in London and Liverpool on the ports. And they are quite well known in Victorian society. They quite often feature in the press. And so, yeah, you can definitely see this real interest and excitement around these exotic animals that are being brought into the country. I think when we were actually doing the study, in terms of people sort of, you know, more normal pet keeping, we found that perhaps there aren't all that many people out there who are actually keeping these exotic animals. There are a few kind of really notable people, like, say, for example, the poet Dante Gabriel Rossetti has a exotic menagerie in his house in Chelsea. And sort of, you know, quite sometimes people in the elite often have menageries as kind of way of, as a form of social display. But actually, ordinary people aren't keeping these exotic animals quite so much. What we actually concluded was that pet keeping on a mass scale was informed by imperialism, but it was more that the Victorians had an idea of themselves that was about sort of the capture and display of animals, and this was kind of projected onto a wider range of animals that they found in the UK. So if you go out and you capture a bird or a squirrel in the wild and then bring it back into your home, that act, if you like, is informed by a broader sense of confidence and a sense that you as a human have the right to bring that animal into your home and kind of tame and domesticate it. So we linked those broader processes, if you like, with an imperial mindset.
And I think, sorry, and you may be able to hear a not very exotic pigeon who's just outside my window who keeps wanting to contribute to this. but sort of a more prosaic way as well in terms of how what we think of as exotic animals enter ordinary homes is where you have sailors. And sailors like to bring souvenirs back from their travels. So in working class homes, you do actually encounter things like monkeys who, you know, where a sailor has brought this animal home as a gift for their family. It usually ends in tears. Monkeys do not make good domestic pets, but it is that kind of that colonial world brought back to the sort of the British kitchen where you get these animals that are not suitable at all, but being kind of presented by working class people as trophies of empire on a very kind of like everyday, you know, in an everyday setting.
Let's talk about how these animals found their way into the domestic sphere. How did it happen and when did it happen? I'm guessing that at some stage first animals, like farm animals, were kept outside. But what happened that they became more a part of the domestic sphere? And what were some of the early challenges associated with it, especially with the rise of small modern flats?
Yeah, so I think sort of keeping animals in the home has always had challenges. I think for some time it was implied that urbanisation and industrialisation automatically saw a removal of animals from the home, although historians like Hilda Keane have argued that actually animals remain embedded in the city in all kinds of ways, even though even in quite a sort of urban modern context. So it's not simply the case that sort of homes become less rural and less kind of animal focused. And actually people were sometimes keeping, you know, costermongers, donkeys, for example, were kept in quite close quarters sometimes in people's households in London in the 19th century. And so there isn't actually quite as sharp divide in terms of that change as you might expect. Yes, I mean, I would say though, I mean, certain kinds of housing present particular challenges. And one of the things we looked at was the different kinds of pets people keep in different kinds of homes. It was more difficult in smaller working class homes to keep dogs, for example. I mean, people still often did, but some working class women, wives and mothers, were quite opposed to having dogs in the home because it was so difficult to cope with them with the rest of the family in quite a small space as well. So yes, and as you say, when living in a flat becomes more common, this again encourages people to keep smaller pets and animals that can be kept indoors. So say, for example, indoor cats are, you know, more practical for people who are living in flats.
We did find some BBC archive footage a couple of weeks ago that suggested some people in London flats in the early 20th century were keeping donkeys in their flats.
That is too much.
Yeah.
Well, although I must say, when I was in New Zealand, I met this really, really interesting fellow. He was 30 or 40 years old, older than me, but he was an architect. And he showed me pictures that he had this small pig back in 1960s, but then it turned into a huge, huge pig. And then some of the neighbors started to complain. I think it was in 1960s or 70s. It was sort of close to the center of the city, and well, he just had to. I don't remember what happened to the pig, but he wasn't allowed. The city council didn't allow him, didn't to keep a pig in the city. So yeah, and he showed me pictures. It was just amazing.
Well, I guess that's it, though, isn't it? Because I suppose a lot of our ideas about what makes a suitable pet are culturally constituted. And that's in relation to what the domestic is and what's appropriate for a domestic setting. Yeah. So these things are constantly shifting. You know, there's arguments now that maybe we shouldn't be domesticating cats and dogs, you know, because it's artificial and we're breeding for domestic use, and is that in itself cruel? So I think these things are constantly in flux, and it's one of the things I think our book does is show how the very idea of the pet, but also the family and the domestic, are socially and culturally constituted and reconstituted again and again.
Well, I was telling Julie before you joined, Jane, that I think I said it here, that I'm trying to convince my wife to have a pet. And one thing we both agreed on was chicken. Huh. We have a small yard, but then we watched the video. You know, people keep chicken. We watched the video and said, no, we just can't. Right? Yeah, I guess there are all these sensitivities around things. And we are very, very fussy about hygiene. So we just said no.
I mean, the thing about animals is, and this is what I guess we love about animals, and it's the stories we love in our book, are you can have, as humans, we can have as many rules and regulations about hygiene and, you know, who can sit on what furniture at what time, et cetera, et cetera. Animals don't care. These rules and regulations mean nothing to them. Mm. And so often when people bring animals into their homes, animals just disrupt everything because they have their own priorities that just don't map onto ours at all. Yeah. And it's usually comfort and food.
Yeah, no, and it's really interesting, isn't it, in a kind of, yeah, in that historical context, because we often think about Victorian homes as very rigid, very kind of ordered with sort of really precise routines. But actually, if you bring animals into that mix, you get a completely different, more chaotic picture. So by kind of acknowledging the presence of animals and what their behavior means in the home, you actually get a really different picture of historic home life in some in some contexts.
I think that extends as well to kind of thinking about the homes of the working classes, where I think there's often a tendency to think of them as drab, colorless and loveless, and comfortless. I think what our book shows is that bringing an animal into homes that perhaps don't have much access to other resources, an animal can transform a home with warmth and affection and companionship.
And another part of this argument is this emotional function of animals at home that you discussed at the beginning. What was the emotional function of that affective relationship like for the people who kept pet back then?
Well, I think one thing we kind of expected to find at the beginning of the project was that actually now is kind of peak emotional engagement with animals. And we expected people to kind of be less emotionally engaged with animals at the beginning of the 19th century. And actually that to have increased over time. But I think one of the things that was most surprising for us when we were doing the research actually was the depth of emotional engagement people, you know, right in the early 19th century had with their pets. So, and I think if you look at certain aspects of pet keeping, for example, you know, what happens when an animal dies, you can really see the depth of that connection.
I think it's particularly brought into focus when people live either in unconventional relationships and households or when they live alone. You really see the way that that companionship with an animal is emotionally fulfilling. And it is that the affectivity of animals, it's that touch, the smell, the warmth, kind of it, and those practices of care, caregiving, that really cultivate those emotional connections.
And that reminded me of a video that I just came across by accident of an old man who had recently lost his wife. And that was the caption of the video, that is, their children had bought him a dog. And it was a camera in the house that recorded how he was playing with the dog, and it was smiling, and it was all happy. And his children were, of course, happy that he hasn't sunk into depression. And I guess with the rise of pets, we also have the rise of vets. What was that dynamics like? And I don't think that all people had access to or had the financial resources to have access to vets. So how did when did this vet phenomenon become more common in England?
Well, in the 19th century, the veterinary profession was expanding, but actually most of the practice was for working animals. So horses predominantly, some cattle. And so actually most people, when they wanted to treat their pets in the 19th century, actually did it themselves. And there was a really vibrant market in pet medicine. So you could buy all kinds of pills and lotions to treat your pet at home. And pet advice manuals also gave advice on how to deal with various pet ailments. So in the 19th century, most people were engaging in this culture of treatment of pets at home. And then it seems in the late 19th century, some vets started specialising in particularly in high-end animal care. So as the pedigree dog market, for example, expands, it makes more sense for people to go to vets to treat their animals. And so we gradually see an increase in the use of vets from where we identified it in the late 19th century. And then in the 20s, this really starts to expand. And by the 1950s, we're starting to see a shift in veterinary practice towards small animals. So vets at that point are shifting away from their focus on horses, as horses start to sort of go out of working use. And that's the point at which it becomes more common to take your pet to the vet. But there's more to say about that story. Perhaps Julie Marie can come in.
So I think from at least the 1880s, if you read veterinary professional journals, vets are already looking ahead and saying that the market for horses looks likely to be declining, whereas there is this booming market in domestic pets. And so you start to get conversations from the 1880s, 1890s amongst vets themselves, in that they foresee a growing market in the domestic pet trade. And so they start to invest in doing research on small animals. So this is kind of like a really long story. But also vets and animal welfare charities realize that that market is restricted to those that can pay. So in some of the research we did, we noticed that the first clients of vets were royalty and gentry. So what we see is by the 1890s, we start to get a proliferation of animal welfare charities, and they start off generally focused on livestock. But what they also realize that there's this booming market in pets and pet keeping, and they start to be anxious about poorer people not being able to afford treatment for their pets. And so organizations like organizations that are now called Blue Cross and the Dogs Trust and the RSPCA start to pay for poorer people who cannot afford medical care for their pets. Those charities start to pay for poor people to access medical care. Now that starts in the 1900s. So it's actually really quite early, and much earlier than I think we thought we had expected. By the 1920s, those animal charities are running animal hospitals that are for the pets of the working classes. And usually they will pay for you to access treatment. We also have the foundation of the People's Dispensary for Sick Animals, which again is aimed at providing the pets of the poor with access to medical treatment. So these things kind of, it's multi-layered and multifaceted to get us to kind of the mid-20th century, which is a veterinary market as we would recognize it today.
Let me ask one final question about the book. It's pets, some places were sometimes were a status symbol. How did the ideas of class, gender, or wealth manifest themselves in pet keeping practices or even in burial ceremonies for pets?
Well, I think at a basic level, you can see certain kinds of pedigree dogs, for example, are more expensive, which again, that transforms them into a status symbol. And to a certain extent, cats, actually, from the late 19th century as well, certain pedigrees of cat. So the kind of pet you keep can itself be a status symbol. But I think it's very hard to see animals as just status symbols. And in almost every case we find, animals could contribute to people's, people's sense of their kind of social prestige, but there is usually an emotional connection as well, which means that the animals aren't simply status symbols.
And I think one of the things our book does is try and bring into view things that have been hidden. So for example, the emotional connections that working class people had and the grief they felt when their pets died, even though perhaps they weren't able to afford access to a grave in a pet cemetery or to bury their pet in their gardens. So I think what we try and show in the book is these emotional connections that take place in different demographic groups. And some are just more visible than others, but it doesn't necessarily mean that if you didn't have the status symbol of a very fancy pet grave, it didn't mean that that emotional connection wasn't there. So I think what the book tries to do is complicate that story on lots of different levels about conspicuous consumption and animals. Of course, there is an element of conspicuous consumption, but it's much more complicated than that.
That emotional connection also reminds me of another thing. So I live in Australia, and I'm guessing it sort of was maybe a global trend. And Australia, especially Melbourne, had the longest lockdown in the world compared to other cities. So the idea of pet keeping became more common during COVID days. But then I guess after COVID days and the economic impacts, more and more people had to sort of, they either left their animals outside or just gave them to shelters. And I realized that there's this, lots of animal shelters were asking people to come and adopt the animals, cats or dogs, but it just goes to show that emotional connection can never go away. And I have a couple of friends who have two cats, and they tell me that even if you kind of say something not nice to the cats. They kind of take it personally. It's like you're insulting their children. So that's the level of emotional connection they have established with the pets. I've never had a pet, so I might not be able to identify with that, but I certainly understand how that affective bond can be established.
You're missing out.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to convince my wife. I'm trying to convince my wife, and I still don't know. I might if I'm ready or not. One thing I know is I want a cat. I'm too lazy to have a dog and take him for a walk every day. I guess cats, and my wife does tell me that I'm like a cat myself. So if I want her attention, I'll go to her. Otherwise, if I'm busy with my books, I just want to close the door. You're like a cat yourself.
Oh, yeah, you'll get on great with cats.
Yeah. And before we say goodbye, is there any other project you're working on? Any other books we should expect sometime soon?
So what we found is we found so much really rich material and so many wonderful stories doing this project that we could carry on writing about pets for the rest of our careers. So there is much more to say. And in a sense, the book only touched the surface. And I think, some of the questions you've raised here just are like the beginning, they're apertures onto much, much bigger stories. So I've no doubt that we will carry on with pet projects for many years yet.
Yeah, and I must say, I love reaction books because of exactly what you said. It's great for academics, it's great for scholars, it's also great for public readers. And the book, what I really enjoyed about the book was that it was not like typical academic books that might have lots of details that kind of put off some people. So you touched upon a lot of interesting ideas, and it gives the readers a lot to think about. And you're absolutely right. You're scratching the surface, but it does, when you read the book, you do feel that there's still more to be said. But I could understand that you're writing it for the reaction, for that famous series. I think it's a series they with reaction.
So there's an animal series, and I think one of the things we really wanted for the book was we did all this research and we really wanted to share it with people. We wanted people to be able to read it and understand it, and it not just, sit in a library gathering dust. So yeah, so we hope that it's accessible and that it gives people an appetite for learning more about animals.
Great. So thank you very much. The book we discussed was called Pet Revolution, Animals and the Making of British and Modern British Life. Jane and Julie, thank you very much for your time to discuss your book with us on New Books Network.
Thank you.
Thank you.